Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Susan Violante. I'm your host for today. I'm really excited to be speaking on the phone with Sam Mossy, author of To Kill the Duke. Set up during the Cold War in the 50s, To Kill the Duke captures political duplicity and amorality in a satiric tone, making this a relevant and entertaining read. But before we start, let's learn a little bit about Sam Mossy. In 2006, Sam was a victim of a hit-and-run accident. Not being able to move, he started writing and never looked back. Few books and years later, Sam is currently in conversations with a Hollywood producer about his book. When not writing, Sam can be found observing human nature at one of his two bars in the Youngstown, Ohio area, where he lives with his wife and muse, Juliet. For more information about Sam, visit him at www.killtheduke.com. Hi, Sam. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here to talk to you and your listening audience.
I am really excited about making this interview because I've always been one to follow the 50s era, just how Hollywood responded to all the problems that were going on with Russia and the Cold War and all that. But I was wondering, how did you come up with this setting at all?
It's kind of funny. I was researching... when I wrote my third book, Nomad, I had a character that visited New Mexico, and I was looking, I was researching communes there. That's where I was going to put the character, in an old-fashioned hippie-ish type commune that has progressed over the years and changed as culture and society changed. And as I was researching, I came across in New Mexico there actually were a lot of communes, and I came across this one that hid a gentleman by the name of Herbert Biberman, who was a director and married to the movie actress Carol Sondergaard. And they were running around in the 50s from the FBI, the IRS, the United States federal government, you name all the law enforcement of its day, but they were card-carrying members of the American Communist Party. And they actually filmed a movie on the run called The Good Earth, which had been banned by a lot of... places because it's pro-communist, and they're filming it in New Mexico. Anyway, as I was doing all this research on it and totally getting away from my book because I was so engrossed with the characters, I came across some declassified Kremlin articles that there was actually a plot by Joseph Stalin at the height of his career and power in the 50s to kill John Wayne, the American movie star and icon.
Wow.
And that's how that's where I started
reality,
from.
Reality, Dan.
Hmm?
It is based on some real fact, the book, then.
Right. That's what got my mind, and it stayed in the back of my mind while I was, you know, finishing that book, writing another one, doing all the other things I have to do. And then once I got into it, it was actually inventing the imaginary characters, the made-up characters, that was easy. But taking the real-life characters from John Wayne to Joseph Stalin to Mickey Cohen to Johnny Stompanato, Susan Hayward, Dick Powell, and countless others who were real-life, and making them speak the way I wanted them to speak to make the novel go, that was difficult.
Why this subject about... I mean, yeah, we know you found this on your research, but is there any background to you that has to do with Hollywood or politics? Or?
Oh, I've always been my mother brought me up on movies, on Hollywood. I mean, she's probably a walking encyclopedia of movies. I tried to get her on some of those television shows where they had trivial questions and whatnot. She'd be a champion. She installed a love of movies, the arts, writing, reading books, art to me. And so that's where that comes from. And I just kind of like grew up. I was always being dragged to the movie theaters and by my mom. And, you know, I just fell in love with that. But I never could see myself in Hollywood doing anything other than watching the movies and sightseeing.
Yeah, yeah, like most of us. Phyllis, I'm curious about you now, because for somebody to write something just for the passion of what, you know, and the research that you found, makes me wonder, you know, who are you as a person? Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, I'd be glad to. It's always fun to talk about yourself. I was born in Boston, Massachusetts. I was born deaf in my right ear. So going to the movies was, that's where I first learned how to read lips, and I did pretty good at it. And that also, because of that, my mother did kind of always force me to read, because I wasn't going to be allowed to play sports or anything of that nature because of my deafness in my right ear. So I had to find another way to spend my time while my friends and peers were all out doing sports and whatnot. I wasn't really allowed to on team sports. I could do individual things. So I just absorbed myself into all the writings that I could. And I came across, as I got older, I got into two genres that really excited me when I was reading. One was biographies. I just loved reading about everybody, historical people. Some smart, some no one ever heard of, some everyone had, some somewhere in between, and fiction. And I loved fiction, and I loved Kurt Vonnegut was my hero, and I just got into that whole thing, and just really got into that, and other books like that, and then I and unfortunately, what happened is I wrote for my school newspapers, and I did all that sort of stuff you're supposed to do. I really wanted to become a journalist, you know, and have a column. That was my goal in life. And when I graduated, I'm 51, when I graduated from Wittenberg University, a great school in Springfield, Ohio, the Bloods, the economy was much like it is today. Mm-hmm. It was just terrible. But the difference was interest rates were sky high. It was like 18 to 19% to buy homes and cars and whatnot. People had money, but they couldn't borrow money. And a lot of people weren't hiring and this and that. It was very similar today, except for the energy cost a little bit cheaper. So it was very difficult to try to find a job. I volunteered. I moved back to Boston to look for a job, hoping to land that great job as on a newspaper. And the closest I came was to actually delivering newspapers to put food on my table. Why I wrote the Boston Globe, why I wrote tried to write short stories, and little by little, my money was running out, my patience was running out. Then all my friends seemed to be doing well. They all got jobs, and here I was, busboying, delivering newspapers and what have you, and not really getting anywhere. And I decided to join the real world of the business and put my writing to the side, and got a job and went into the real estate business. You know, I got married and raised kids, and it took 20 years before I picked up that pad and started writing again, and only because I was the victim of a hit-and-run accident. And in that accident, I received 12 broken bones, 6 in my neck and shoulder,
wow,
and 6 in my lumbar. And I was laid up almost in a device that Kurt Vonnegut would have designed, and I couldn't move. When I couldn't move, I was always in a device or had a cane and this and that. It was very difficult. I couldn't do my work. I had to take a leave of absence. It took about a year and a half to recover because I didn't want to get operated on. I could have done that, and instead I went through the lengthy patent time where I also learned to grow a vape patient, which I never was before, of rehabilitation. And I started writing, and from that I got my first book done, and I just haven't stopped since.
Yeah, and it's amazing how it takes something like that to happen for us to go back to our true passions.
Yes, you know, as I've been on the circuit and meeting other people and with interviews like this and whatnot, I find that a lot of people have just had to put things to the side and then go pursue their dream after they, you know, proceeded to conquer some things, whatever that may be. Let's see, I live in a beautiful Poland Village in Ohio. It's in Ohio, but you would think you'd live in New England if you're here. I guess that New England part of me never really left. I'm always kind of searching for that small little town type thing. I'm divorced. I'm remarried. I have 5 children, 3 from my marriage, 2 from my wife's marriage. We have 2 son-in-laws. We have 3 grandchildren, and we have 2 dogs.
And then you have a few books, or is this your first one, or?
I'm sorry, what?
You have more than this book?
Yeah, this is my fifth book.
Your fifth book.
My fifth book. My
you
first book was...
You went from a real estate guy to an author with five books. And for our listeners, his newest book is To Kill the Duke. And your website is www.tokillthedukes.com. I encourage everybody to go and check it out because it's a very interesting premise. And I actually have a question for you on that because, you know, the world has changed so much, especially the politically, all the political, the whole world is just a big mess. Like, I guess it could have been right after World War II in the 50s. But the Cold War is no longer there. Now we fight terrorists. And yet you chose to write during this era a book that starts, you know, that steps out into the 50s, even though it's you're concentrating in the film industry. There is a lot of political context of the era. So I'm wondering, how is all this relevant to our days? How did that come up in your mind?
I think it's a very good question and observation. Thank you. I think it's relevant that, you know, the bad guys and good guys, depending on what side you are in the Cold War, you know, I look back at it and did a lot of research and did a lot of reading, and then my own, the way I was educated and brought up by in schools and family, we were two nice, brown people. And that's part of the reason that comes out in the book. You know, the American way of life was doing great in the 50s. You know, we were the country. We were rebuilding the world. We were the dominant power in the world, and everything was going our way. Yet what happened was we needed a bad guy. We always do. And who do we pick? We pick the Russians and the communists. And we developed this whole, as Eisenhower called it, the military-industrial complex. And what did they do? Keep going to wars, undeclared wars, which we have now, but that hasn't changed. And we spied on each other. We had the House Un-American Activities Committee that went around, led by Joe McCarthy and Richard Nixon, two of the most despicable characters in real life in American politics, and one became president, unfortunately, and they went around, you know, and people calling each other communist, and so they ruined people's careers, especially Hollywood. They executed people, and things, our civil liberties were really at risk. They're still at risk today in a whole different fashion. I mean, the 50s ended, our civil liberties came back, the Cold War kind of warmed over, but it really never did.
Yeah.
What happened was with the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had we went from the undeclared war in Korea to an undeclared war in Vietnam to an undeclared war in Iraq. Now we have this undeclared war on terrorism.
Yeah.
That might take us into Iran. And I'm starting to sound like a politician. I don't know if I'm a writer. But, you know, it's scary. I really believe the word, when I wrote this book, it's almost, if you go back into the 50s, you can really learn about where we are today from that aspect. I mean, the only thing we're not running around calling each other communists, boy, we sure do call each other, if you watch some of these political shows and read, we call ourselves a lot of names now, don't we?
Yeah.
We're really nasty to each other, and it's too bad. And we Americans, and that's what I tried to, get across in the book is that, it's funny that our enemies can be the terrorists. Of course they are. They back in the 50s, it was the communists for whatever reason. It's funny though, you know. My dad fought in World War II and is buried in Arlington National Cemetery, and he always told me, he was in the Air Force, and he could never figure out that, he remembers meeting Russian soldiers after in 45, after the Russians and the United, you know, the Allies beat the Germans, the Nazis, and 2 years later, we hate each other.
Yeah.
You know, but there was no incident other than the fact that, you know, the Russians wanted to take all that land, and they wanted it as a buffer zone to keep from Europe to ever attack them again. So, I mean, I guess we have to, it's that old saying that we really have to learn about today. We have to learn and understand our past.
It is true. And if you look at the past and you compare it to today, in many instances, you wonder, whether the historical things that happen and that are currently happen are actually provoked by some of the leaders because of their agendas and their ideas. So I wonder how far will leaders go with their ideas sometimes, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, great point. I mean, Stalin did try to kill John Wayne. And it's funny, I had a review that was done for me, and this gentleman really did some more research that he got, you know, he loved the book, and he did some more research on the 50s, and he really had some insight into some things that what was happening to Stalin, that allegedly Stalin did send two agents to California to kill John Wayne. And the FBI tipped off John Wayne about it, and they Wayne and a bunch of other Hollywood stuntmen and other actors kidnapped. They kidnapped the two agents, brought them to the shores of in Malibu late at night, early, and they said they were going to execute them. And then they actually put on a fake execution because they were all Hollywood people with one to scare the crap out of the two would-be agents, and they allegedly went back to Russia scared to death.
Wow.
That's what some archives. I mean, who knows? You know, one thing I've learned is that there's so much we don't know as citizens that happened to these larger-than-life characters or larger-than-life institutions. You know, and so as a writer, it's great because I can imagine it. Now, my Russian hit squad isn't they do something totally different, which I really would have believed would have happened. If I was a Russian in the 50s, where everything was it was cold, it was dark, you have to wait in line for toilet paper, no one had washing machine, blue jeans, all those things we can go to the local store and get, no local mall. If I was a Russian agent and I was sent to America, I'd have a hard time going back to Russia. And that's what happens to the, I don't want to spoil it for the readers, but that's what happens to the elite hit squad that goes there. They don't go back.
Yeah.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Sam Muffy, author of To Kill the Duke. Stay tuned, because we are going to continue this interesting conversation with Sam. But in the meantime, if you want to check out his website, it is www.tokilltheduke.com. There was a lot of spying going on during the 50s, and to the point that all industries were, if anybody suspected that you had communist ideas, you would be basically persecuted by even your peers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering, how is that this spying business going, how has it changed since then?
The communist?
Yeah.
I just think I think communism has become, obviously, I think people look at how communism fell. They were an empire for 80 years or so. They took over all those countries parts of countries that they didn't give back. They had to prop up the regimes. They had more people that they had to take care of. They weren't producing much because they didn't pay to produce in communism, right? You only did so much and you had to stop. So, it kind of keeps the shackles on people, and it collapsed. And then they got involved in wars, too, Afghanistan, and also they had to keep up with the Cold War, right? Can you imagine how expensive it is to fund a worldwide weapon system? And you have to keep up with the Joneses. In this case, it's the United States, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just the sheer expense. Do you build weapons or do you build roads? Do you build weapons or do you build bridges? Do you build weapons or do you look for alternative energy sources? What did they do? They built weapons and they went broke. And so the communism, we look at communism now, right? What are the two I can only think of two communist countries out there. Do you know of any others besides Cuba and China?
Well, right now, you know, Venezuela.
Oh, right, Venezuela, right. Yeah, me and my geopolitics.
I'm from Venezuela originally, so that's why I have it present.
Okay. Well, isn't it, but Cuba, we still have a trade embargo against the country that's starving to death. That would probably be a great asset to the United States, become a great tourist attraction, probably lower the price of cigars and sugar cane and things of that nature. We don't do business with them. But tell me why, maybe you or your listening audience can tell me, why do we do business with China?
Yeah.
Why don't we do business with Cuba, but we do business, they're both communists. So I can never figure that out. I guess I think we buy oil from Venezuela, don't we?
Yeah.
So I never could figure that out. So
the current interest of our leaders, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, but that's part of the thing. It's just like it's really strange. So communism to me, to us, you and I, and the listening audience and my readerships and all the people, it doesn't mean what it did back in the 50s. I get to answer your question. I came a long way around. Communism back then meant something. They were scared to death. They were going to fight the nuclear wars. Remember that duck and cover? Your voice sounds like you're a lot younger than I am. My brother is an older sister. I'm the middle of seven. Used to tell me, you know, when they were in middle school, I was just a little kid, that they would have to do these things, you know, duck and cover drills. I mean, that's how stupid we were, too. A nuclear bomb goes off and you get under your desk and you're going to survive? I mean, if you think, you know, or build something up in your backyard, you know, and you had all that stuff going on. But what the funny thing is, and I'll bring this into the book, is where all that was going on, the duck and covers and all that stuff, the Russians never, ever did above-ground nuclear testing. They always did underground testing in Siberia and in vastly places where there weren't many people. Yes, there were people, I'm sure. Yes, there were probably animals that were killed and all that, and stuff contaminated and all that. They did, but they never knowingly exposed their citizenry. We did. The United States government did that.
They took more risks.
Knowingly exposed any, people, especially the United States soldiers, used as guinea pigs. And that becomes a big part of the background of the above-ground nuclear testing in the atomic test site in Nevada, Utah, and parts of California, which is a background of my book where they film a movie called The Concorde. And to me, it's just amazing that they filmed on all this sand. They filmed this movie on all this where all this contamination was.
Wow.
And over 25% of the cast members of this movie that was filmed on location for a couple months developed cancer and died.
Wow. You know, things like this makes you think about things. Because, you know, during the 50s when all of this turmoil was going on, and we have a lot of turmoil also with terrorism and our way of life had changed, and, you know, we were attacking our own ground. So there's so much turmoil now, but during that time there was also a lot of fear, and there were many things going on. And yet I have this system where, you know, you want to know about your history, just watch the Hollywood movies, you know, because if you want to know what's going on in a certain era, the films and the books will talk about it more than the history books, in my mind. And so, it seems like at that time, Hollywood was not as outspoken as it is now.
Right.
And I wonder why. What was going on? And, you know, what made the difference? How come today actors and actresses and the whole, the communication media, or what is making people?
Hey, by the way, I think what you do, you go back and you go back to the era that you're interested in, and you either watch a movie or read the letters that people wrote or read the newspaper headline. That's an excellent historical perspective.
Oh, yeah.
That's good research. That's good for you.
Witness. Yeah.
Yeah, good for you. That's what I do, too. That's how you learn. Because you and I are biased because we live in the year 2012. You have to go back into I had to go back into the 50s and pretend I was living in the 50s to get that idea to deal with people. But that's an excellent you should pat yourself on the back for doing that. Hollywood back then, you know, in my research and my own knowledge, there was a real split in Hollywood, and two of the characters in my book were involved in it, and one being John Wayne and one being Dick Powell, who directed and produced the movie, who's a major character in the novel. They were part of the right, we call the right-wing conservative viewpoint of Hollywood. They were trying to show America that we were getting rid of the commies that were in Hollywood. And there were a lot of leftists, especially the writers, directors, writers, producers, who were, they were members of the Communist Party. But don't forget, in the 50s, they were probably 40, 50 years old. They came of age during the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
They were left-leaning at that point anyway. And then you have the war, these people's, a lot of these guys, most of them were men, fought in the war. So they went... They became of age in the Depression, fought in one World War II, and now they're not communist anymore. They're whatever they are, Democrats, Republicans, Independents. But because they were 20 years before, Hoover, McCarthy, and Nixon and their gang, I call them the Cold War Warriors. That's what I call them in my book. Had to punish them. So it wasn't what you were today, what your accomplishments were. What they looked at was, you went to a Communist Party meeting. And then what happened is the worst thing that happens in America throughout history, is that people started finger-pointing. They started finger-pointing. And what happened was they made, a couple hundred actors, directors, writers, actresses scapegoats. So if you and I were both successful actors and actresses, an actor and actress, and we went and we saw that these people's careers were ruined, very talented men and women's careers ruined, we'd probably shut up just to get a job.
Yeah.
Because the old, go along to get along, maintain the status quo. So that was big enough. And those that spoke out against the prevailing winds with malcontents, like I know Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, and others, Groucho Marx, they spoke out against it. They weren't card-carrying members of the Communist Party, but they didn't like what was going on to their fellow Hollywood people. So they started to speak out. It was Edwin R. Murrow, newscaster, who started to speak out against McCarthy. Eisenhower finally was set up with them, because it was terrible. But in my research, those that spoke out got their heads cut off. Never worked again. There was the Hollywood 10. They didn't work for years. And they had to work under nom de plumes. They had to endure all sorts of public humiliation. Some of them went to jail. Some of them went broke. Some of them lost their marriages. I mean, just terrible stuff. And a lot of them were Academy Award winners. They were wonderful, talented people. And it took 10 years to break that blacklist. Kirk Douglas did it in Spartacus. That's a trivia question. If you ever want to knock somebody off their... feet, you should say. Who was the actor and what was the movie that he directed, wrote, produced, that broke the blacklist? And that was Kirk Douglas when he made The Great Spartacus. And he gave Dalton Trumbo, who was one of the Hollywood 10, a fabulous writer, a fabulous man, who was in purgatory for 10 years. He put his name up on the big screen, written by Dalton Trumbo. And that hadn't happened.
Now it seems that, the more controversy an actor has, the best publicity.
Right. Yeah. Well, right. That's what we've turned into. And that's an excellent point and observation. In the 50s, if you were controversial, it was bad.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's totally gone 180 degrees. Good publicity, bad publicity is good publicity.
Yeah.
It is. People I think that some people say that's true. Some people say it's false. I know there's some local politicians where I live who say, as long as they spell your name right, who cares? Well, I would. I wouldn't want to be saying Sam. A dead. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I killed somebody. Well, my name's spelled right. That's not that bad publicity. But they don't see it that way. They're in a different world. These political leaders. But to go back to your question about the Hollywood, why Hollywood saw outspoken now, I think that's where it started. Well, that's where it stopped. Are you familiar with the director, Kazan, Eliza Kazan?
I'm not sure. No.
He did On the Waterfront, one of his famous movies. He did Streetcar Named Desire. Well, okay, real famous director in the 50s, made Brando a big, big star. Okay. He named names, okay, but they told him, he was a great director, they said, if you don't name names, you're gonna ruin your career. So a lot of people were told that. So they named names. And some of these people never did anything, but they had to give them names so their careers could, so Kazan's career could go on. Well, he won some Oscars and whatnot, and then about 15 years ago, I think, he was honored with a Hollywood, you know, you know how they always do
the legendary
award, yeah, for the night. Well, they made him the recipient, and a lot of people who were still alive, they were remembered, wouldn't stand up and clap. It was kind of controversial, and it brought it back just a tad bit about what happened. But I think what happened was, you look at like, okay, why is someone outspoken? Well, Michael Douglas' father is Kirk Douglas. He grew up in all this. He saw what his dad did eventually. So he's going to be more, he's going to say, well, I'm not going to let this happen again, to his credit. He becomes outspoken. His sons become outspoken. A lot of people in Hollywood are all the sons and daughters of famous stars, you know, or they're connected, they're somehow connected. They, you know, the families just stay in there. And I think they grow up in that, and they grew up hearing about things like that, and they decide to be outspoken. Not all of them, I think. Well, look, Angelina Jolie, her father's John Voight.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense that you know, that's what's gonna. It's a natural way. It's like you know, when our, you know, when you're a child, like I'm my parents survived World War II in Italy, so I am outspoken about that because I want to make sure that the schools, the government don't infiltrate in the schools.
Right, yeah, and I think that's what's happened. I think they're outspoken. I think another reason they're outspoken is they can afford to be.
Yeah.
I mean, the actors and actresses of today make more money in one picture than some of our great actors from the 50s of Hollywood made in their entire careers.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's good. I'm glad they are outspoken.
Yeah.
It's up to you and I, as the audience, to say, hey, I like, you know, like, I don't like a lot of Sean Penn's politics, okay, but I admire him for speaking up for what he believes in, and I think he's a terrific actor. It's not his personal politics doesn't make me go, oh, I'll never go to one of his movies. I don't boycott his movies. I enjoy him as an artist. I don't enjoy him as a, him and I would not get along too well in a political discussion. But that's okay, you know, I mean, but that's his right, and I think that's good. I have that right, too. You have that right. Why can't Hollywood people speak out? I think
yeah.
It's great.
I think it's great, too. Gee, I could talk about this all afternoon, but we, unfortunately, are running out of time.
Okay.
I want you to share the good news that you told me before, but before, let me remind our readers, to find out more about your book and yourself and your story, go to www.tokillthedukedom, and that is tokillthedukedom.
Yeah, and I will say, if there's a...
Could you share with me before? Please share with our listeners, because I'm pretty excited for you.
Okay, thank you, and I appreciate it. And you're the first one. I'm so used to breaking news, because your timing is perfect. By the way, you can link to my email on my website, so if you want to talk to me directly, I love talking to people. Okay. My novel, To Kill the Duke, was just optioned by a Hollywood producer by the name of Archie Gips, G-I-P-S, from Glad I Thought of It Productions. He just finished the Justin Bieber movie. That was his last project. I don't know if you have a younger audience out there, I don't know if Justin Bieber is going to be in my book. Oh, my novel, excuse me, or the movie. And so I'm very excited about that. It's the first time it's ever happened to me. It's kind of funny because I wrote a book about that Hollywood is the backdrop on it, that someone found out about it, picked up on it, and really liked it. And they told me that for us older audience, movie audience lovers, that Hollywood's kind of shifting gears right now, and they're going to more historical fiction.
Well,
like my book. That's why it was optioned. My timing was perfect.
Yeah. Well, it will be very, you know, we'll stand by and see how Hollywood interprets all the stuff that you wrote about Hollywood.
Yes. My wife keeps going, who the heck's going to play John Wayne? That's the topic of our dinners. Who's going to play Howard Hughes?
Yeah.
Who's going to play, you know, that? So.
So we'll see.
We will.
Interesting news, and again, thank you so much for being with us. Again, listeners, to find out more and keep, you know, keeping yourself posted for this new development with this novel, go to www.tokillthedukedom. Sam, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. It was a really nice time, and you had some great questions and comments and observations.
All right, and listeners, thank you again, and until next time.